Let's see what the stew has for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, the Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew. So I guess we'd better be good. Today we have Matt and myself, Ange. Today we're going to talk about Matt's recent article, Extrema Drop Map. But before we dive into the main topic, let's ask our get to know a gnome question. Matt, do you remember the first time you played an RPG? You know, what character you played? Did that first game hook you for life, or did it take a few more tries?
Yeah, I do remember. I was at a track meet in grade school, and my friend Kyle something was telling me all about his Spelljammer campaign, where they rode a dragon across the stars, and he chewed up ballista bolts and spit out rockets and blah, blah, blah. And I'm there like, that sounds so cool. I tried to find the books, and they were nowhere. We were in the middle of East Bumble nowhere, and I got the AD&D first edition books through interlibrary loan, and then I finally found a copy of the Moldvay basic set, and that's the set I had to work with. And I had to run my very first game, having never played anything. And it was interesting, to say the least, but it was a lot of fun. And turns out, you know, all my neighbor kids that I played it with went on to play D&D at least through the rest of high school, usually with more competent DMs than I. So that's my intro to DMing story. And tell me all about your first gaming experience. Did it hook you for life, or did it take a few tries?
No, it did hook me for life. It was an interesting experience because it was my senior year of high school, and a new kid had seen me reading a big fat fantasy book and asked me if I liked D&D. And I'm like, well, I've never played. And he's like, do you want to? And I'm like, yes, I do. So that Saturday, he showed up at my house on his motorcycle to pick me up, which of course gave my parents pause because, you know, their daughter's leaving the house to go somewhere with a boy on a motorcycle.
Uh-oh.
You know, and I'm like, it's fine. I'll be fine. And they're like, okay, you're going to be home by a certain time, right? And I'm like, yeah. So we get over to his house.
Let me interrupt for a second. If they knew he played D&D, they wouldn't have been worried.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, as it was, it eventually turned out that he didn't like girls anyway, but that's a whole other story. We you know, show up at his house. He's already got a bunch of other players there, and they're like, here, play this character. This person isn't here today. And it happened to be a halfling rogue. It was first edition D&D, and I'm like, I'm looking at this sheet and all these numbers and, you know, all the percentiles for all the thief skills, and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. The first combat, I remember being like, well, I can climb a wall so I can get out of the combat. And they're like, okay, climb a wall. At the end of the session, we got trapped in an abattoir type of room where there was just blood and gore and bits of monsters that had been killed, and we were getting overwhelmed with orcs. And I ended up being the only character to survive that encounter because I hid under all the bodies. And even though it wasn't my character, even though it was just weird and over the top, I was hooked. I was hooked for life. You know, so the next time we played, I made a character of my own, and, you know, that was the end of it.
So who was that first character?
I don't remember his name. I remember it was a male halfling rogue, and I was just like, oh, just like Bilbo. Because I knew Bilbo.
Well, I mean, what was the one you made?
Oh, the first one I made after the halfling rogue was... I remember her name. It was Jesmina Tavilar, and... I want to say she was a mage.
Probably an elf with a name like that.
Nope. She wasn't an elf because one of the guys that was in the group that my friend that invited me, who was the GM, really looked up to this kid, was of the opinion that most people are not equipped to play elves properly.
Don't you love those people?
Yeah, he was a very Tolkien purist and felt that most elves were played by people completely wrong. So, like, he was the only one that ever really played an elf. Because if anyone else played an elf, he'd rip them to shreds. It wasn't until several years later that I actually played an elf.
I think my first character was, of course, a GMPC, because I was GMing for my first game. And, you know, running around with this party of first-level adventurers was a Minotaur. Because I could do that, because I was the GM. I was so awful. I'm still not that good a GM, but I was so awful back then.
Everyone's got to start somewhere. Okay, so let's move on to talking about your article, Extrema Drop Maps. It talks about a neat method for making maps using a pile of dice, and what gamer doesn't like getting to roll a giant fistful of dice? Can you go into describing how this process works?
So, you know, it talks about the mathematical concept of the extrema, which is your mins and maxes. So it's a drop map where you take a handful of dice and drop them on the table and then use the results as your minimum and maximums dependent on, and there's a series of options for how to interpret them in the article. But really, it's a kind of a loose process. So, you know, elevation is a direct correlation. It makes sense. You know, you roll a 20 and that's your highest point on your map and it's whatever you want that highest point to be. And if you roll a 10, that's a high point, but it's only half as high as the 20, so on so forth. But of course, anything that you want, you can relate this process to. You know, you can say, well, I'm going to put some forests on the map, drop a handful of dice, and where you get a bunch of 20s, you have really thick, dense, you know, haunted forest. And where you roll a bunch of 1s, you have, you know, barren lands or scrub lands or low vegetation areas and so on and so forth. So the article is really more of a set of guidelines for you to interpret and play with as you see fit than a hard set of rules.
Yeah, and well, do you have a way to handle if you get, like, a bunch of, like, 20s next to 1s? Like, you get that mix of extremes right next to each other.
So, depending on how you choose to interpret the dice, that could be any number of things. But I guess in that case, you'd really have something fantastic. You know, you'd either have, well, these are my elevations above sea level, and so, you know, you have mountains, and they're really tall mountains, and they're just really sheer and drop off, and then they get down to land. Or you could do like, well, 10 is my baseline, and 1s are valleys, and 20s are mountain peaks. And so then you've got this range of mountains that literally there are just these giant trenches through. Either way, you're looking at something, you know, fantastic and inspired. I think on the example map, I've got quite a bit of that because of the way I chose to interpret the dice. So you can see how, like, the middle of the map there, the elevations are just going up and down and up and down and up and down because I've got a maxima that's like 1,800 feet right next to a maxima that's 2,000 feet, right next to a maxima that's 5,000 feet. Well, in order for all those to be maximas, it has to come down in between them, right?
Yeah, that's true.
You can get really funky stuff like that. Or if you don't want your world to be that fantastic, you just say, F it, and throw away some of the dice and re-roll them. No one knows what you rolled except for you.
It's to me, it's a neat way to you know, I don't do so much mapping in my GMing because, you know, it's not something that I really, you know, have gotten attached to. But I really appreciate, you know, the work that goes into creating maps for games and that, like. And what I do for a living kind of deals with a little bit of mapping. So it's kind of, I always appreciate and enjoy the maps. You know, so it's cool to see a different way to pull one together.
You know, I think maps are this super complicated beast. One of my favorite books from the second edition era is the World Builder's Guidebook. And if you ever wanted a book written by someone with OCD and way too much time on their hands about building a world map. That is the book for you. And it takes you through making a map, starting with your prevailing wind patterns and your tectonic plates and building upwards from there. And I always look at this and then throw up my hands and say, WTF, you know, there's so much work involved here. If you look through my article history, quite a few of my articles are, how can I cheat and make maps with little to no effort because they're super complicated and I should think about this stuff, but I don't want to.
Yeah, it's the... I did play with a GM back in the day who had no understanding of physics or geology or anything like this. And so for me, there was, him putting in these wildly fantastic things that didn't make any logical sense kind of pushed me past being like, this is a fantasy game, this is cool, this is fun, into the, well, that doesn't make any sense, that wouldn't actually work, you can't actually do that. So it's like, I can understand the people getting a little pedantic about it, but at the same time, it's a game, just roll with it. You know, as long as it's not too out there, go with it.
You know, I think a lot of that has to do with the flavor of your campaign too, right?
True.
And the flavor of your rule set. I would say that maybe 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons is very much on the wahoo side of things.
Yeah.
First level characters flinging around fireballs and there's no such thing as a quiet heal. You know, you heal somebody and there's this giant burst of holy light. It's all very MMO, who use those visual cues mainly to let you know something's going on. You know, so if you've got a map and you've got floating islands with giant fortresses that span from one floating island to the next, and you know, that's completely fine, but you don't want to drop that in the middle of, you know, 1E D&D where everything is gritty and brutal and you go through 15 characters before you get to level 2. You got to kind of match the two, I think.
Yeah. There's also a degree of personal taste in there. Like, I have a friend who he's very into D&D. That's the core of his gaming being. And he joined a group once that had this hugely long-running campaign. And he was immediately disappointed to find out that they had never mapped anything about the world they were playing in. There was no map to show where the countries were or where the mountains were, anything. And he was just like, well, that's not very epic at all.
You know, mapping is, and this is one of the reasons that I'm always looking for ways to be lazy in map making. Map making is a double-edged sword. There's a lot of useful stuff in a map, and you can often look at your map and say, hey, what's this country over here that we've never really looked at? And what's their relation to the country we're in? And maybe there are tensions and maybe that starts an adventure and maybe, you know, but at the same time, it's entirely possible. And I know because I've done it myself about a million times and seen other people do it a million times. It's entirely possible to spend months of effort mapping out this huge campaign setting and then never use any of it.
Yep.
Either because the campaign implodes 3 sessions in, or because the type of game that ends up getting run just isn't relevant to that kind of, you know. So you almost want to do what they used to do back in 1E, and, you know, you start with a village, and nearby is a dungeon, and what's over that hill? Who the F knows? Which is fine, but the problem with kind of tacking on more stuff to your game world as the scope increases, while it saves you a lot of work, it ends up looking like that's what you did.
You know, the heartbreak of putting a lot of work into a campaign and then not having it go anywhere is one of the reasons why I like improv stuff so much. Be able to gauge what your players are engaged in and just build that up as you go. I also wanted to point out that right around the same time your article was posted, John found a Facebook post that he shared on the Gnome Stew Facebook group that was a similar method of mapping using giant fistfuls of dice. Except instead of, like, your example using just D20s, this one looks like it uses pretty much every single die you've got, and you let each one represent a different feature that you pull together. And I thought that was pretty cool, too.
That is really cool, and I really thought that share was super cool. But the reason I exclusively went with die 20s, and your mileage will vary, is because they have more granularity.
Mm.
If you use die 4s for an Extrema map, you only have 4 options. You know, whereas with die 20s, you can say, well, this is a 15, and this is an 18, and this is a 20, and those are all different levels. So if you use the die 4 for terrain type, and you've only got 4 basic terrain types that you want to have on your map, that's fantastic. Whereas if you have 4 different heights of elevation, and hey, that might work too, you've got lowlands, plains, hills, and mountains, you know, you just have to make sure that whatever your options are work with the granularity of the dice you're using.
That's really cool. Well, let's move on to wrapping up. Let's give special thanks to our Patreon backers, awesome Gnome supporters like Jack Evans, Hugo Martelakar, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, and Rob Abrazzato. Thanks to their help and others like them, this show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on Gnome Stew's website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. This ad brought to you by math. I bet you thought I was going to say Patreon, didn't you? You can find us all at GnomeStew.com, at GnomeStew on Twitter, and GnomeStew on Facebook. Matt, I already know the answer to this question, but I still have to ask it. Is there anywhere else we can find you on the internet?
Nowhere important. I just mainly hang out at the Stew. But while I have the mic, I did want to ask about those Patreon backers. Do we choose the Patreon backers that we feature in an episode randomly, or are they just the coolest guys we can find that week?
Well, they are the coolest guys, but they're chosen randomly.
Okay. I guess they're all the coolest guys because they're our patrons.
Yeah, if they are a Gnome Patreon, they're the coolest. And there are a few not guys.
I'm sure. I was using guys in the gender-neutral understanding, although I guess that shows my age. That's probably not appropriate anymore.
I have to break myself of that one, too. I use guys as very generically, and it's not necessarily the best use of it. But anyway, do you think we avoided the Stew this week?
Probably not, no. You won't be hearing from us again.